So I'll go ahead and tell you this because it's going to become very apparent very fast. He is a full-on Threnody Shade.
Okay, got it. Or Canticle Shade if you want to get technical.
Sure. Yep. It is everything as terrifying as I think we are meant to think. And yet, these characters are unsettled by him, but not bailing out of the ship and running for their lives unsettled.
And he's perfectly coherent and talking. Like, our yes. Shades on Threnody and Canticle, while they seem to maybe have the potential for this, certainly weren't anywhere close to having a right. conversation about cravats and hairdos.
Welcome back to Following Noadon, a Stormlight podcast. Today is, let me check the notes, episode 281, Isles of Emberdark, continuing on into the darkness, into the black pages that we discovered last week. We are in chapters 22, 23, 24. We have met back up with our character Starling. I'm excited for a bunch of stuff to talk about with you guys today. Trevor and Paul, how are you guys? Paul, I'll start with you.
Fantastic. Fun fact. Just a couple days ago, a friend of mine stopped by our house, and he's a fan of the Cosmere and of our podcast, and he's read Isles of the Emberdark, and he was like, hey, can I look at your physical book? And he had no clue.
Oh, that's cool.
That the pages flipped to jet black, and he was blown away. He thought it was the coolest thing ever. It is the coolest thing ever, for the record.
It is.
It's not, he's not alone in that. But yeah, I thought that was really cool because he audiobooked it and didn't have the physical book, but got to see that and flip through. I'm sure he looked at a lot of things that I'm not yet allowed to look at, but either way, he was pretty blown away by the black pages. So shout out to Sam. I'm sure he'll hear this in a couple weeks.
Trevor? So
other than that, I'm doing good. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. You and Sam are both doing excellent.
Yeah.
Trevor, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm feeling a little intimidated by the summary that I have to do in about 30 seconds.
I'm looking forward to this.
Just really prolong your how are you doing bit.
Well,
so that
no,
you
that
don't you don't have it. To no, do
you
the
gotta
summary,
attack
right?
your fears, Paul. You gotta you
nope.
gotta conquer
if you just
them.
Keep going, then it'll never arrive.
You don't conquer Patchy by running away from the death ants. Actually, I think you do, but you have to capture the death ants.
I'm pretty sure that's an important part of surviving Patchy. Anyway.
Well, with that said, time to face your Patchy, I guess. Trevor?
Yeah. Chapter 22 of this book is a doozy. Holy cow. Okay, so into book two, titled Starling, and we kick off with Starling, although we do return to Dusk by the end of the episode here. So chapter 22 and chapter 23, I will combine in my summary because they're basically the same chapter. We are on board the Dynamic, the ship, the Dynamic, in the Emberdark. It is contracted from Zysis, from Tress of the Emerald Sea. Lots of spoilers about the
should
drop,
we,
like
should we
everything.
Count, should we count the name drops? I'll count the name drops while you go.
Okay, yeah, great. Count the spoilers that we have to disclose as well by the end of this chapter summary. I think it's at least like four books. Okay, so we're on the Dynamic. That's new. Contracted through Zysis, Trust of the Emerald Sea reference. However, we are under the orders of Hoid. Specifically, Starling is under the orders of Hoid. And she is under the captainage of Captain Crow on the Starling, or on the Dynamic. And it also employs a Sleepless, who none of the crew like, and they're all afraid of this Sleepless.
Reasonably
doctor,
so, by the way.
Completely reasonably. And I mean, that's the scariest thing that they think's on the ship. But the scariest thing that's actually on the ship is a shade named Nas, who we definitely have met before. Paul, quick, what do you remember about Nahs off the top of your head?
Okay, well, that's a really tough question, Trevor, because I really don't remember much about Nahs, like, at all.
I have a presentation for you later.
And I feel bad. I feel bad about it, but I will have you know, I easily noticed and remembered the name.
Okay.
But I did not remember, like, really specifics past that. So okay. I was trying to think back in the memory banks. I didn't do any research on it, so I'm sure it will benefit greatly from your presentation.
I have a presentation. The Sleepless's name is Chrysalis. We have Nahs. We have Captain Crow. We have Starling. We also have Adatil, who is our engineer. She is from a planet called Dautry, I think. And apparently there used to be a perpendicularity on the planet, so they used to be able to get on and off really, really easily, but then the perpendicularity left. No explanation on that. So getting back to Dautry is really hard, and Starling buys Adatil a ticket, and that's like a really emotional scene for Adatil. And then there's one other character. I don't remember his name.
Are you really not going to explain what Adatil is?
Oh, well, yeah. Okay. Adatil's an ether bound. Yeah.
Okay.
Minor detail.
There we go.
That was a really big deal. Yeah.
No. I mean, she's got a dead ether, and she coaxes the ethers on the ship to keep going because they fall asleep.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll go back to more details on the dynamic here in a second. But in chapter 24, we then jump to Dusk. Notably, there is no time skip between chapters. So presumably these chapters are happening simultaneously. I'm going to make that assumption because there's no 5 years ago, 55 years ago, whatever. These chapters are happening simultaneously right as Dusk is setting off into the Unsea or the Emberdark or whatever we're deciding to call it for this book, because we've used all three terms of Shadesmar, Emberdark, and the Unsea. And he finds a snake. He's like, "Ooh, look, it's a 5 foot long snake. I'll try to, you know, bring it close by turning off I never remember this bird's name.
Roque.
Turning off Roque's power. And then it just keeps getting closer and closer and bigger and bigger. It turns out that thing's like a whale snake. And that's where we have Dusk.
Okay, can I briefly talk about this whale snake? Okay, I could be totally wrong and remembering this wrong, but I swear I remember them talking about this snake. He was like, "Oh, it's like 5 feet long," from his initial like guess. Right? He said it's about 5 feet long, and doesn't he say the head is like a foot wide?
Yes.
And I was just imagining. I'm like, obviously, this is a fantasy snake, and then in the cognitive realm, right, from as we learn, a very warped perspective, it's not actually this size. But I was trying to imagine if you had a 5 foot snake that had a foot wide head in real life, like, it'd be the ugliest, funniest looking thing that you would ever have seen. Like, it would probably look comical or terrifying. I don't know. It would look so stubby. You've never seen anything like that, a foot wide head with a 5 foot snake. Like, you've got some big snakes out there that are like 35 feet long and have big heads.
Sure.
But not like a little 5 foot guy.
What about like an eel? Eels have like those really big wide heads.
They have more tall heads because they've got more
right.
like jaws, but they're not particularly wide. They're more like oval shaped, kind of like
upward. And like eels that. Are pretty long and skinny themselves too. Like yeah. You're right, the proportions here are a little odd.
It instantly bothered me. I'll be honest. Like instantly, I heard 5 feet long and a foot wide, and I'm like, no shot. Like the closest thing, if anyone here knows much about snakes, the closest thing I could think of is a blood python, which is just kind of a notoriously short and fat snake. But like, it's not anywhere near this. You're maybe getting 4 or 5 inches across, maybe. Anyways, I digress.
I love all of your guys' thoughts. You're gonna get all of this answered for you at some point here. So that's right. Don't worry.
We do learn that it is, in fact, not 5 feet long.
Correct.
But this initial description, I was like, maybe that was my clue, how preposterous,
let's use some proportional math real quick.
The snake was.
Let's use some proportional math real quick. So he guesses a 5-to-1 ratio, right? 5 foot long, 1 foot wide. But then he just discovers that it could swallow the boat. So that would stretch it to like 20 feet wide and 100 feet long. Is that better for you, Paul? Is that like a...
That makes a lot more sense to me. I understand that looks quite thick and stocky still, but like if it's that big, where like I'm looking at it and its head is way, way larger than like me and this boat, I'm no longer caring how long it is. Like this is no longer a normal snake, right? Like this isn't what we're talking about.
You guys are full on Elliot over analyzing this.
This is very important, Elliot.
I am here for it. Let's go.
Like I said, I had no problems afterward, Trevor, with the dimensions, but it was simply that first mention. He's like, it looks to be about 5 feet long. It's a snake that's 5 feet long, and its head is a foot wide. And I'm like, no, it's not. You're so off of this dust. I couldn't believe him. So-called expert trapper from Patchy.
We should have included this in our art for that we commissioned last year.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, we should have known.
I've got two questions for you, Trevor, coming out of your summary. First is, you mentioned your assumptions about the time frame that we're in, that you're assuming these events in the Dusk storyline and the Starling storyline are happening at the same time. Yes. Without revealing anything, how does that make you feel about your prediction of my question about when Dusk might speak to Starling?
Oh.
Does it make you feel better or worse?
Good. At the end of chapter 23, we just dipped off into the Ember Dark after a distress signal, which I guess we can talk about at the end of the episode or whatever. But after a distress signal, which I assume is not Dusk. But I had this really strange thought today, or maybe yesterday, as I was listening to the chapters. I do think Kakuban is important. I do think Kakuban we have met before. And Elliot, you said in our previous episode last week that Dusk is putting a lot of stake in Kakuban, and that Kakuban has done this before, therefore it is doable.
Yes.
What if it's like the interstellar thing, where the wormhole is placed because we were there to place the wormhole, therefore we went through the wormhole to place the wormhole. What if Dusk is Kakuban?
Oh man, okay, here we go.
What if Dusk is Kakuban and there's some weird time dilation thing happening here? What I had the thought. I don't think we're doing time dilation stuff in this book, but I had the thought of, what if this is possible because Dusk thinks it's possible?
When I was reading this the first time, I had similar thoughts to that, actually. But then I went a different direction because I was also not too long ago reading a Wheel of Time book. And
yes.
Reincarnation is like a big thing in Wheel of Time. And that was kind of the direction I was going with it. Oh, Dusk is the reemergence of Kakuban kind of thing. But I like your theories on the time dilation. I have another question for you.
Okay.
You forgot a character in chapter 22.
What's his name? The bird guy.
The bird guy. So we do have one other member of our crew. His name is Zizi, and he's a Lawnark, whatever that is. And he has feathers instead of hair somehow.
It goes out of its way to say that it's not a bird person. It's a person that has developed feathers, which
is a feather human. It's a feather human. Anyway, that does set the scene for us. So with that, we can start talking about the actual events that happen in these chapters. So chapter 22, with all those new characters, lots of new characters, lots of references, we are going to get into some spoilers for a variety of things, largely Tress. We've definitely got some Tress references.
Tress, Mistborn is not going to be avoided either.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably about it.
Well, yeah, a little bit of Stormlight, but that should be obvious. Yeah.
Some minor Stormlight.
But with that, where do you guys want to start with the events of Chapter 22?
There are so many tempting rabbit trails to go down in this episode, and I'm going to be very hard-pressed to know which one to chase and which one not to. So, Paul, you start.
I was going to say, I think I have a good direction for us to go down. So, Starling mentions she remembers the words of Master Hoid, which I thought was fun. Master Hoid, her mentor or whatever. Hasn't Hoid given her a specific direction on something to do, and that's why they're here? Or do we know the full picture of why is Starling here right now? What is she looking for? What is she doing? Right. Was that clear to us in this?
I don't believe that's spelled out in this chapter at all. Okay. I think we get the impression that you're talking about of Starling seems to have worked with Hoid and maybe has some kind of direction coming from him, but I don't think it's specific.
So the impression I got was her shackles, her curse, or whatever you want to call it, is inflicted on her via her own people, the dragons. The dragons have given these bracers to her to block her in human form. And then Hoid and Zeiss come in later. That's my understanding. So we're under Master Hoid, but we're also on this ship contracted from Zeiss. Do you remember who Zeiss is, Paul?
Yes. Okay. Zeiss is our dragon friend in dress.
Very nice dragon. Imagine Dragons. Remember that episode?
Imagining dragons. Yeah. I'm imagining a dragon too. Yeah. I remember, of course. sorry. So, okay. Yes, you're right. We're on this, like, essentially, Starling is. I get the picture that she's been excommunicated from her crew, her home, her family, her planet in some way. We don't know why. I expect that's what we will learn, is some notable event happened that she's banned from being a dragon and somewhat excommunicated. I'm expecting that to be unpacked further and further. This obviously was introducing us back to Starling and the current state and this new crew. And I do want to say, I really appreciate the distinctness within this crew. We have a very eclectic, different assortment of individuals in this crew. We've got a Sleepless, a Shade, an Aether Bond person.
Mm-hmm. An Aether Bound.
An Aether Bound. We've got Starling, who's a dragon. We've got Captain Crow. Like we've got a pretty good mix of individuals here.
All we're missing is a Chondra.
You're right, actually. Maybe there is one. Who knows?
Sure we don't have one?
Yeah, Mr. Grown Feathers. I'm like, that sounds like a Chondra thing, you know?
Could be, yeah.
Yeah.
He just ate a few too many birds, and now he's got feathers coming out.
Exactly. You know, they talk about how complicated it is to make all the hair and stuff like that. Who knows?
That's true. That's good detail to remember, Paul.
So, we have this, and I appreciate it because I feel like I was more, compared to, if we're talking about Tress, they feel way more distinct and easy to follow for me than the Doug crew in Tress. You know, we've got a very easy to remember crew here. And also a very, not only is it, quote, easy to follow in my mind, I think it is exciting. I'm like, how the heck is a Shade and a Sleepless going to interact? Like, we're really just putting all these different things in a room, and like, I'm curious to see how it goes. That's essentially what we've set here, is Starling is not a dragon right now and in trouble of some sort, probably with her people, and she's on this interesting crew here. So yeah, there's going to be a lot more to learn, but it's quite the entry point. We're getting quiet. We're really getting dropped into the thick of things, it feels like.
I want to talk about the ship itself from the perspective of Starling. Starling is the lieutenant under Captain Crow, so second in command, presumably. And as described by Starling, the dynamic is like a hodgepodge, the Millennium Falcon of the Emberdark. It has a a Rosharan anti-gravity technology, aether fuel, and a Scadrian composite metal hull. And I was thinking to myself, okay, cool. We're all working together at somewhere in the cognitive realm. We're working together to make starships. And then the very next sentence, Starling says, except each of those systems could make ships by themselves. This one's just a composite of all of them. And I'm like, well, okay, never mind then.
Yeah, this is someone found the junkyard and was halfway decent at welding. So they welded up a junkyard ship.
Yes. And just based on this, I have lots of Stormlight spoilers incoming. I have completely changed my frame of reference on Stormlight Era 2. Completely. I think I'm going to guess that this is pre Stormlight Era 2 still. And that Stormlight Era 2 happens after this book.
Interesting. I feel like the general comments I've seen, and I've not done a ton of research on this, would actually disagree with you, but keep going.
I'd be happy to be pointed at the evidence that I'm incorrect, assuming I've read it yet. I assume that Retribution is still around from the Skybreaker guy we got earlier in the episode or earlier in the book. That's a big assumption, but I'm assuming the Retribution is still around because Scadrial and Roshar are at each other's throats. I feel like that would be a big reason why is if Retribution is still around. Therefore, that leads me to think that we're pre Stormlight Era 2 because I can't help but think that we've handled Retribution by the end of book 10. I feel like that would be a good assumption to make. But now, if we really are before Stormlight Era 2, I have to completely rethink my like technology era of Stormlight Era 2. Because we were just confirmed by a dragon that Roshar has their own starships, that they're starship capable in this book.
Yep.
So either we're after Stormlight Era 2, and Roshar and Scadrial are still at each other's throats, or we're before and Stormlight Era 2 goes completely sci-fi and starships and ether fuel and, you know, all that. Did you track with all that?
I'm definitely tracking with you. I like the logic path for sure. This is going to leave us with some interesting questions here in this book, I think, about the state of Roshar. I think you're asking the right questions. We're going to have to get into it more when we finish the book. I think sure. that'll be a topic I think we cover maybe in our book wrap-up episode, because I think we're going to be able to ask some of those questions in different ways there. But yeah, it's interesting. I think I will say that most people I've talked to think that this book is way in the future, like quite a ways later. And we think Stormlight Era 2 is only 10 years or something like that, right?
Here's the problem. Way in the future for who? Way in the future for who? Because we've just time dilated Roshar. That's the problem.
True.
So the whole time frame of like Stormlight being 30 years in the future, 30 years in the future for who? For Roshar or for Scadrial?
I think that's that time dilation though possibly may not support the thought path you're going down of Roshar is the one moving slowly and everyone correct. Else is moving more quickly. So if the rest of the Cosmere has 60 years and Roshar only has 10, I'd be a little surprised if they come out of that 10 with spaceships.
I would theorize that Retribution would send his Skybreakers off to another planet that's not time dilated to go do some research.
That's possible.
And by the time we unbubble Roshar, then Retribution has all the technology and our Knights Radiant do not.
Yep. Yeah, could happen.
I think that is very fair. And I absolutely see what you're saying, Trevor. I'm still withholding my thoughts for now. One, just because I feel like we're bound to get a lot more juicy clues and context, maybe. We're still very, very early in this, especially like book two. We don't hardly know anything yet.
Sure.
About what's going on. We could see maybe I'm very curious. I really want to know what conversations potentially between Starling and Hoid could have been. I don't know if we'll see that. But if so, I feel like that could maybe give us some context as to where we are in this. But yeah, I want to join the conversation, but I'm like, I'm kind of just withholding it. I don't know yet.
I
see what you mean. What you're saying makes sense, Trevor. But also, I don't know. It's hard for me to sit here and say that Stormlight 6, after a couple of years on Roshar, there's going to be starships and stuff. I feel like we're not going to have that drastic of a jump.
And it's very possible that in chapter 25, next episode, everything is completely flipped on its head. So I completely understand not going off the rails, but that's my job.
All right. We should probably keep going because we've got like 12 other things we got to cover in chapter 22 alone.
Okay, let's stay with the crew. Captain Crow. Okay, so what do we know about Captain Crow, Paul?
Oh, gosh, that's like the one character I think I know the least about here. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I could talk about any of the others. Captain Crow, I didn't really.
Captain Crow is an Etherbound, I believe.
That's Adatil, right?
Correct. Adatil's also an Etherbound. But
they both are?
Captain Crow is being eaten by an Aether the entire Book of Tress. Remember?
Yes.
She's being eaten by an Aether. She needs to drink water constantly.
Oh, okay.
To live.
It's all coming back.
And at the end of the book, Tress trades Captain Crow so that Captain Crow won't be eaten by her Aether. Remember this?
Yeah. Yes. Crow gets sent like into servitude of Zysus, right?
Yes, because he needs a floor scrubber.
Yes.
And Captain Crow will presumably scrub Zysus's floors for all eternity. And in exchange, he pauses her ether that's eating her because he needs a servant to sweep his floors. So, fast forward to whatever this is. Captain Crow is the captain of the dynamic. And presumably still being eaten by her ether. We're about to meet her, I suppose, in the next chapter. But I assume that she still has an ether issue.
So she's staying hydrated.
Correct. So yeah. I assume there's going to be some of her drinking water or something. And then she's in service to Zysus. What do we know about Zysus? He's a dragon. He enslaves, indentured servitude to a bunch of people, and you go trade your people for a boon from Zysus, and that's the thing in Tress.
You think that's how they got connected, Starling and Captain Crow, because Starling might know Zysus?
This is a complete guess. But I assume that the dragons, Manacle, Bracer, Starling, send her off world, and she meets Hoid. Hoid hooks her up with Zysus, and that's how that starts. That's my guess as to what's happening here, is Starling gets exiled, meets Hoid, then meets Zysus, then meets Captain Crow.
I see what you're saying. I feel like I'd have one other slight guess. One difference from what you're saying. I bet she gets manacled, but Hoid is there and tells her, we're sending you off. Go to Zysus. Okay. There you'll like get sent off further. That'd be my guess. My one adjustment to that.
So what's your vibe then of the situation here? Is Captain Crow a good guy, or are we good guys under the command of a bad guy?
Captain Crow's absolutely not a good guy. However, I don't think Starling is in service to Zeiss like Captain Crow is. I think Starling is just the lieutenant on the ship serving Hoid, and the ship is under Zeiss's control.
Okay.
I think I can agree with that. The jury is still out on a lot of our characters. Like Chrysalis, for example, our sleepless or Horde friend.
Friend?
I feel like they're, I feel like that's the whole point they make. They're like, everyone is afraid of Chrysalis, because it's obviously a bit unsettling whenever you're talking to somebody and their face crawls out a bunch of bugs and stuff. You know, it's a bit, you know, you don't trust them as much, maybe. Bias.
They're whatever. A little shifty.
Yes, a little shifty. Precisely.
Come on, that was a good one.
No.
I want to point out on the sleepless that I noticed when I was reading these chapters, it seems like sleepless are much more well known in this time period
for all the wrong reasons.
Right. Yeah. They don't like the sleepless. They fear the sleepless, but they all just seem to immediately know, oh yeah, sleepless. Whew, stay away from them.
Well, okay. Yeah. Let me phrase it like Starling does. Zeetsi, I think is the name. He's spying on Chrysalis. Yeah. And Starling comes up to him and is like, you know, you really shouldn't spy on Chrysalis. And he goes, well, she spies on me, so I get to spy on her. And he says, well, you know what they did in my world, right? And Starling says, no, but I can guess based on what they've done to everybody else.
Yep.
And I'm like, what? What?
Yep.
The sleepless are apparently on a rampage. Mr. Cunningman is back.
That stood out to me, because when we've seen sleepless before, they seem like very behind the scenes. Most people don't know that they're even there.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we get to wherever in the timeline we are here, and it's like, oh my goodness, sleepless. Yeah, they are the Death Star of the Cosmere going around just destroying planets.
Yeah.
I agree with that entirely. It felt like it was trying to, I felt this kind of pull that you were supposed to jump on this bias that Chrysalis is an evil, sleepless, and sneaky and not to be trusted, but that Chrysalis is actually just kind of like chill, like misunderstood, you know? I don't know if that's the case. We've seen another nice sleepless before, like thinking back to Yumi, right? Not Yumi herself, but in that book.
What is her name?
I don't remember.
She says it like once.
She like specifically says she like is kind of disconnected from the other sleepless though, right? In Yumi?
That does ring a bell, yeah.
Y'all remember that? I feel like that was the case. So she's not like the other sleepless. Anyways.
She's like disguised as the emo girl that draws like bunny rabbits with teeth and stuff like that.
Correct.
Yeah.
But I don't remember the name.
But so anyways, we have Chrysalis here. I'm very curious to see where this goes, because I've gotten the impression from these initial chapters at least, that Chrysalis is not like a bad guy. Jury's still out on that. I'm not going to stake a flag or anything, but that's kind of the impression that I've been given, which is kind of funny because they make such a point of sleepless are the worst. They destroy everything. They've destroyed planets. They've like corrupted whatever. So I don't know how I rectify those two points of view, but yeah, I'm curious. So you're right. They're very well known, but something else I want to key in on is they talk about how still nobody knows how many sleepless there are. Like there's still an air of mystery around them.
Yeah.
That I'm so curious to know. Some people think it's all like there's just a couple or a couple hundred or something. Some people think there's more. or less, it's still a bit mysterious about like how many there actually are and how big they are. But yeah, they're just like essentially everywhere.
Raffo.
I'm convinced that this, I should have thought about this, but Mr. Crumbling Man completely went off stage for Wind and Truth. So maybe this is why I didn't. Big Wind and Truth spoilers, by the way, about incoming. When Cultivation flees Roshar, I feel like that should have had some pretty negative repercussions for the Sleepless. If the Sleepless really were in service to Cultivation, and then their shard just abandons them, like, is this like the Sleepless Unchained across Roshar? Is that what's happening here?
Maybe. All right, so we've got Chrysalis the Sleepless, who nobody trusts, but Starling's trying to make everybody be friends, at least seeming so in the first few chapters. We have Captain Crow, who we definitely don't trust. Who else do we have on board?
Adatil. Adatil has an etherbound, is an etherbound from Dawtry, but her ether is dead, and Starling never asked why. And she's like this, I don't want to say loopy. Give me forgetful? A better one. Yeah.
Absent-minded.
Thank you. Absent-minded, young. The narrator lady does a very young feminine voice for Adatil. I don't know how old Adatil is, but adolescent is the best I can describe for Adatil. And she's very young and forgetful and sorry, all like everywhere. And yeah, her ether is dead. That's about all we know. She's homesick and she just got a return ticket to Dawtry.
I thought it was funny how they described, oh yeah, we're just kind of a ragtag, sometimes legal cargo ship, sometimes not legal cargo ship. So we can't afford the nice ethers. We can afford the like secondhand ethers, and they're kind of sleepy. So we need Adatil to encourage the ethers sometimes to do their thing.
This is definitely the Millennium Falcon of the Emperor. Yes. Sometimes yes. Legal, sometimes not.
Right.
Mostly good, but you know,
right.
If the Skadrians stop us, we might run.
It's got a computer system that's maybe kind of crazy, and you have to sweet talk it into doing the things you want it to do. Yeah. It's basically the Cosmere version of the Millennium Falcon. Who else is here?
Our bird guy, Zitzi. He's from a planet that's been completely destroyed by the Sleepless, and the Sleepless, Chrysalis, is like, don't worry, I won't enslave him in chapter 23 to Starling, as if that's supposed to be reassuring.
Like, encouraging.
Yes, like, I could, but I won't. You know, I could. I could make him go insane, but I won't.
We usually do that, but don't worry, I won't.
Right. Yeah, I'm in a good mood, so it's fine. And yeah, so that's our ragtag crew, except for the white shade in the room, Naz,
who just comes like floating through the wall.
Yes.
With a hairdo that Starling makes fun of and a fancy cravat.
The chapter actually starts with Naz. And so I thought as I was listening to this, like, oh boy, I'm going to have to do some research. Paul, what do you know about Naz? Besides, he's like on Scadrial sometimes. Did you even know that?
So I was trying to, I heard the name Naz, and like I said, I started thinking back, okay, where do I know Naz from? And I was like, was this in one of our like Arcanum Unbounded stories? Was this like, yeah, was this Scadrial? Like, I was trying to pinpoint where.
You're 2 for 2 for correct so far.
And I wasn't ever like 100% sure. I thought that this might be the assistant to Chris.
3 for 3, correct.
Oh, I am. Oh,
you're doing great.
Okay, so I remember more than I thought. That was my like guess, but hearing it here, I didn't think that was right. I thought this was just a character I completely forgot about. and didn't know who it was. So I moved on. I was like, I'll figure it out in our episode. That's why we have these, right? Really, it's, you know, first time readers perspective podcast, right? And I am very much the first time reader. And even though we've read all the Cosmere, this is an awful lot to keep track of. So I'm grateful we have somebody. But did I crush it? He's the assistant to Chris.
You crushed it. But let me put it this way.
Let's go.
It'd be really hard to miss him because he's everywhere. He is in every single story. And I just realized this about 45 minutes ago prepping for the podcast. So I opened the copper mine and I used their handy dandy time machine feature and told it to tell me everything that it knew about Nahs before Emberdark was published. Because I didn't obviously want Emberdark spoilers. Mm-hmm. Here's what it comes up with. He is sitting with Chris in Mistborn Seer history. And he talks to, I almost said Kaladin. He talks to Kelsier when Kelsier dies. Uh-huh. Mistborn spoilers, sorry. Chris and Nahs are sitting by a campfire waiting for Preservation to die. And they're going to take some notes. Do you remember this? And Kelsier jumps in and says, whoa, who are you guys? And Chris and Nahs look over him and say, whoa, what are you doing here? You died. And they're like taking observations about the Lord Ruler. So they give him some pointers about going to see the Iri, I think they're called, the Selish people who are here to steal Preservation. That's the whole Mistborn Secret History random plot that we go on. Beyond that, he is in Mistborn Era 2 in the broadsheets. If you pay attention to the broadsheets, there's some sensational writings about Allomancer Jack. And they're written by Nikki Savage is the author. Nikki Savage apparently has a source, and Nahs is the source. I just learned this 45 minutes ago. Quote,
wow.
Nahs and Nikki Savage meet when the former tries to steal a map of New Saren that Nikki has inherited. The map contains a hidden pocket with information from Nikki's father, which is why she pursues Nahs. And the two end up fighting over it, parentheses, though Nahs seems to be under the impression that this is just a regular, if very good, map. Though angry with him for his theft and mystified by his odd weapons, Nikki seems to find Nahs very attractive. She calls the timbre of his voice very enjoyable and apparently is mesmerized by his exact appearance. Seems kind of random. Okay, backing up.
Missed that in Mistborn Era 2.
Me too. Okay, yeah. I bet you missed this too. On Roshar, Nahs or Chris seemed to have some interest in Shallan and her journey. He marked where she had made landfall of the map of on the map in the Frostlands and dove to retrieve some of her old drawings from the bottom of the sea. While in the camps, he snatched Shallan's symmetrical map of the plains, and he refused to provide Chris with the details one with the detailed one showing every plateau as he'd have to create it himself. So, where do we get this information from? The art in the book. Any map that you see in the book is Nahs recreating it for Chris as she's taking notes on Roshar. And these are all like little excerpts on maps, like little side footer notes on in your book. So if you ever go through your book and look at like notes of the Shattered Plains and stuff, those are all written by Nahs.
This is a pretty big drop.
Yeah.
I had no idea about. I feel like I'm back in Cosmere 101.
Me too. I learned a lot opening this article. And just as a little kicker at the end here, has nothing to do with the Cosmere, but Nahs was created by Isaac Stewart. As such, Isaac Stewart owns the rights to the character. He came about accidentally during the writing of The Rhythmatist. When discussing the book, Isaac kept mispronouncing Nazalar as Nazraloth. Brandon joked that those were two separate characters, with the latter being an alter ego of Isaac himself, which became an inside joke in the writing group. So, Isaac Stewart actually has the legal rights to Nahs, and Brandon has to ask him permission each time he puts him in a book, which I thought was a funny inclusion.
That is wow.
There you go.
Great. So are we finding out? I feel like it's very possible that Chrysalis is somewhere in all of our books too, right? Our sleepless people.
I mean, that's definitely confirmed. It's just which part of Chrysalis.
Sleepless. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
So yeah. We've concluded that Nas is just about as Cosmere traveled as Hoyt is, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, if not more. He and Chris go around making their notes in Arcanum Unbounded. So
yeah. But apparently now he's dead.
Wearing a cravat.
And a fancy hairdo.
Which made me think that he was on Scadrial when he died. Because thanks to Wax, we know the cravats are in style by the end of Mistborn Era 2.
So, after all those adventures, Nas is apparently dead, but still sticking around as a shade.
But one gets over those trivialities.
Ah, yes. And it took me a little while to get over the fact that the other times that we've seen shades, which were the other Arcanum Unbounded story, Silence something.
Shadows of Silence in the Forest of Hell.
And in Sunlit Man.
Sunlit Man. Yeah.
Freaking terrifying.
Okay, question. Starling offhandedly calls him a shade.
Uh-huh.
And then mentions that the rest of the crew find him unsettling and we shouldn't have a shade on board that's equivalent to suicide or whatever she says.
Uh-huh.
So I'm a little confused. Is he actually a shade, like a Threnody style shade? Or is cognitive shadow and shade just a synonymous term at this point?
So I'll go ahead and tell you this because it's going to become very apparent very fast. He is a full-on Threnody shade.
Okay. Got it. Or canticle shade if you want to get technical.
Sure. Yep. It is everything as terrifying as I think we are meant to think. And yet these characters are unsettled by him, but not bailing out of the ship and running for their lives unsettled.
And he's perfectly coherent and talking. Like, our shades on Threnody and Canticle, while they seem to maybe have the potential for this, certainly weren't anywhere close to having a conversation about cravats and hairdos.
I agree. Who else do we have on board? Was that it? I think we got everybody.
There's a couple things we don't have on board. We don't have an awakened metal mind. And that's like an industry standard for a starship. And I was like, oh my goodness, my brain. I don't want to think about an awakened metal mind and what that can do. But I'm going to do it anyway. So an awakened metal mind presumably is an awakened copper mind, which would be like the computer for the ship. And you could awaken a copper mind and then...
like AI.
Like having like a starship computer and talking to your starship computer and having it, you know, compute your stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking of too.
But I feel like an awakened metal... I feel like there's a lot more in that can of worms, which I'm not sure I want to entertain.
Where my brain went to is actually a reference that I don't think either one of you guys are going to get because I don't think you've read this book, but I bet some of our listeners out there have. You guys, I'm sure, know Christopher Paolini, who wrote the Aragon series.
Yes.
I know you guys are familiar with that one. He went on to write
Dragonsteel.
Oh, cool.
You saw him at Dragonsteel too.
Did I? Was he there?
Or was he there the previous year?
I think he was there not that year.
I don't think he might have been there when we were there.
It was probably
He and Brandon definitely hang out. Not that long ago, he wrote a sci-fi book called, I don't have it in front of me, it's kind of long, To Sleep in a Sea of Stars, I believe is the name of it.
I've heard of this, yes.
It's a sci-fi book. It's actually a decent read. I enjoyed it. In that book, they have what they call ship minds. And it's like a person that is so integrated with the computer that they're not really a person anymore. So they're full on half human, half machine. And it actually made me think of this. It made me think of that when they were talking about, oh, well, we're missing our awakened metal mind. In Christopher Paolini's story, you like can't fly ships unless you have a ship mind. So, yeah, what's an awakened metal mind capable of? I don't know.
Or do you?
Or do I?
I don't think you do.
I don't think I do either. Speaking of technology, every one of our characters carries on them a Lodestar.
A Lodestar. It's your universe. It's your phone.
It's your smartphone.
You scan your instructions and it interprets it for you.
These are going to come up again, although they're not going to go into too much detail. But these are kind of cool, I think. This is a cool idea from Brandon. Of if you've got a computer or a system on your ship, but you want your ship to be flyable by a dozen different species and origins and ethnicities, you maybe have to design it to be capable of 12 different things, or everyone just carries around their own universal adapter and plugs my personal Lodestar in, and now I can just fly the ship with my own controls that I like, and the ship can read those. I thought it was pretty cool.
Do you think Starling has two for human form and dragon form?
Oh, good question. She definitely doesn't right now because she's locked in human form. No dragon for her.
That's what I was going to say. Not for a while, at least. So, Trevor, do you think we will see Starling restored to her dragon form at the end of this book? Is that where we're headed?
We better. If we get a dragon POV and we don't actually get a dragon, I'm going to be very upset.
That's fair. Well, does a flashback count? Do you think we're going to get Starling flashback to how... Because, okay, so Dusk flashbacks have been the story of Six of the Dusk that we knew. But if we're looking at this story that we're looking at now, Isles of the Emberdark, would we not get flashbacks for our other main character, Starling, here? Do you think we're going to start to do that? We got that in the prologue, right? But I wouldn't be surprised if we even like flip the page or something and it's like, 50 years ago, Starling, or however long it was. I don't know how old she is. Dragons are complicated.
That's a really interesting idea. I hadn't entertained the idea of more flashback chapters, but you might be onto something. If it is, I don't think it is. I don't think we're getting any more flashback, and we're just going to have to piece together what happened to Starling in the present day. But if we do, I'd be quite excited about that.
I think we are going to get some. It may not be frequent as Dusk was, but I think we will get maybe a couple, or at least like several mentions or thinking back to it, of course. But I wouldn't be surprised if we get like an actual flashback chapter for Starling. In fact, I want to. Like, I'm on the side of I think that would be cool and insightful. So I'm kind of hoping for it. I'm also wanting some more page time because now we have Starling in the Emberdark and we have Dusk in the Emberdark. So the good question, when are they going to meet? In my head, I'm now like, they could meet at any point. That does not mean they're going to meet, period. It could still not happen in this book. But it's like in the same room, if you will, if you want to refer to the Emberdark as a room.
Yeah.
Like it seems like Dusk is in a tough spot. So naturally, if another bigger, more prepared, well-stocked ship comes by, maybe you'd be like, hey, y'all got any more bug juice and water over there?
Yeah, but he doesn't want the help of the ones above.
You're right. He would not. However, even the most rugged individualist, Dusk, if he is faced with death, he'd probably... Or who knows? Maybe Dusk will save them. So... You know, no telling what's going on here.
Without spoilers, do you want them to meet soon? Are you pushing for that, or do you need them to wait a little bit?
Well, without spoilers, I'm hoping for some flashback chapters and maybe some other things. We can do some side plots first.
Okay, I see. I think, Elliot, what page are we on?
I was just flipping to look this up for you because I figured you were going to ask me. We are on page 160 of the book at the end of chapter 24.
Okay. Yeah, all right. We need to get moving for me.
We have not gotten to either one of your page guesses yet, but I might have to start warning maybe one or two of you guys somewhat soon of your page coming up. We'll see.
I did not know we were at 160 yet. That in my head, we were at page like 85.
No, 90. No.
So yeah, we're cruising through this.
We are about a third of the way through the book.
Okay. Yeah, so then we've got Mr. Dusk all alone.
Yep.
With our disproportionate snake.
Yes, with our very disproportionate snake. No need to remind me of that. We'll be just fine.
I got bad news for you, Paul.
It's more of like, I picture like a, I don't know, a big caterpillar. You know, like it's just a big chunky worm. I don't know.
I wanted to point out two more things before we wrap up this episode and we keep on reading. The first was, I really liked the introduction of Starling's character here in this chapter. You know, we met her in the prologue, but we didn't see too much of her besides bubbly teenager kind of thing. Here in chapter 22, we actually get to know her a little bit. And one of the very first things we learn about her, I'll just read this section. Her master said she worked too hard to find sunlight in dark places. But what else was she to do? Darkness was commonplace, and she preferred a challenge. When I read that, and that's on the very first page of chapter 22, it's like the 10th sentence you've read about Starling that's not the prologue. I read that sentence and I immediately went, yes, I'm going to like this character. I really enjoy Starling's insistent focus on the good. And as that quote says, maybe she's a little too optimistic. I don't know. We'll find out. But the fact that she takes focusing on the light and not the darkness as a personal challenge, I love that. I resonate with that a lot.
I think the audiobook narrator matches that point of view because it is the most happy-go-lucky, optimistic voice I've probably ever heard reading a book to me.
She's a little too bouncy and ditzy for me.
I was going to say, frankly, it's not been my favorite.
A little too perky.
Michael Kramer and Kate Redding. It makes it feel like this. I'm listening to a children's book. Like,
yeah,
this is exactly who you want reading, like the Hungry Hungry Caterpillar to your like kiddos, you know. So, but not. I'm not like, wow, it's ruining anything or anything like that. But it is very happy-go-lucky at the moment. So.
I will say I don't blame the dragons for putting the bracers back on her if she's just like
bouncing. Whoa, slow down.
As a dragon the entire time.
That could be bad. Could be bad. There was one other thing I noticed, and I only just noticed it this read. I did not notice this at all the first read that I went through. When I flipped the page and started chapter 22, it for some reason caught my eye that the writing style changes. And I don't know if this is a artifact of our flashback chapters in book one were all written by Brandon a long time ago. And he's basically used the same things word for word. And now this is kind of more modern Brandon writing. But the writing style that I'm talking about is the sentence structure gets noticeably more complex, like a lot. I don't know if this would come through in an audiobook or not.
Interesting.
But in all of book one, even the modern day chapters, not just the flashback ones, the sentences are very, I'll just say, like straightforward sentence structures. You don't have very many giant compound sentences. And then all of a sudden in chapter 22, when the pages go jet black, you do get a bunch of giant run-on sentences, and he starts to use M dashes everywhere. Do you guys know what an M dash is?
ChatGPT, is that you? I'm not actually accusing him of that, by the way.
Does ChatGPT use M-dash?
Is that just that wide dash?
That is a staple of ChatGPT.
That is actually how you spot ChatGPT is a ton of
that.
Those big wide dashes. Yeah.
That is fascinating. I would never accuse Brandon of such a thing, but
it's a joke.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. But the M dashes start to appear all over the place. Like sometimes a dozen on a single page where he's using these pause M dashes basically in the place of commas everywhere. And that is not at all in book one.
I assume that's just the different POV between, because I assume it's not in chapter 24, right?
That's a great question.
I assume it's just a different POV that Brandon's trying to put himself in the shoes of Starling and going from this thought to this thought to this thought without a period, you know? And yeah. Dusk is a lot more methodical and slower.
Just flipping a brief glance over chapter 24, there are a fair amount of M dashes, not as much as in 22, but the sentence structures do look simpler. You're right, because Dusk is very, like you said, methodical, simple, one thought after the next kind of thing, and the sentences do reflect that, whereas Starlings are way more rambly.
Yeah, I bet that's intentional, and I bet there's both, that it's a progression of Brandon's writing and he's pushing into it to try to discover Starling as a POV.
Yep. But it really stood out to me on the second read. I didn't notice that at all the first one, but second time it jumped out at me.
That's all I had. Elliot, what are his two navigation ideas that he could do? You have that in the outline.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the Dusk chapter a little bit. We kind of already did. The snake, it gets bigger. He freaks out. Oh my. We should point out he's very encouraged by the fact that there are animals out here.
Right.
That is a very good sign for him of one that might help him navigate if he can figure it out. And two, it might help him eat if he can catch one of these things. So good sign that he's seeing snakes, even though they're larger than his boat. He muses a lot in this chapter about how, man, there's no navigation methods. How do we do this? And I actually thought of two navigation. I thought of two navigation methods that I think he could use. The first one I thought of on the first read was he's in the ocean. There's no currents. There's no waves. It's a perfectly smooth, flat, not water surface that he's on, right? That's part of his problem. He says he has nothing to work off of. But I was thinking about it as what they could do if they wanted to navigate this place and not get lost was just travel in perfectly straight lines. Do your exploring, but just make sure that you never, ever turn. Just start at your starting island and go straight out for about half as much time as you have food. And then take your engine off of one end of your boat and go bolt it on the other end and travel straight back in the other direction, consuming the rest of your food on the way. And then just keep doing that in every direction until you eventually find something.
Well, your bolts, the engine is throwing me a little bit, but he specifically says he can't do that when he sails just over the quote unquote horizon line, which I'm still confused on how that happens if he doesn't have a horizon line. He sails just out of view of the island, and then he's like, well, I guess I'm in it now and I can't turn around, because I'm sure if I tried to turn around 180 and sail back, I couldn't.
And I think that's because he's thinking about it as if you try to turn the entire ship, you're never going to guess perfectly about the exactly 180 degrees. And if you're off on the ocean or in space by half a degree, you're going to miss your destination by miles. You have to be spot on. But I think you could build a boat that has a space on either end of your boat, and don't turn your boat at all. That's very important. And just travel exactly straight out and exactly straight back.
This might be semantics as well, but I'm also not convinced that Dusk couldn't flip a complete 180 successfully because he has clouds.
He does have the streaks in the sky. Yeah, that's true.
He could temporarily figure out a 180, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
Not that you're muted, Paul.
You're right. Whoops. I was going to say, I don't trust this method because I'm thinking maybe a little too logically. If I'm like, okay, even if like, what, if you have the capability of your like motor, would that like impact things, or like the weight distribution in your boat, like would it have to be perfectly weighted? And the physics maybe probably are okay, and maybe in Shadesmore, if you imagine your boat is equally weight distributed or something, I don't know. But I definitely am like, yeah, you need your boat to have like a flat front and back, and to put the engine on the other end flat to just push you in the exact same direction. Because I'm like, yeah, I think that Dust could do a great job turning it around in a 180, but he's not going to, you're not going to like get it right. Because like, yeah, half degree.
It is going to have to be perfect.
Yeah, half a degree or less, and you are not making it back. Like, you're not finding where you actually started.
So you made a joke about the cognitive realm there, Paul, but something I did actually notice is the snake doesn't appear until he has committed mentally to this, and till he has, at least in his mind's eye, lost sight of the island. As soon as both of those things happen, that's when the snake appears, which I thought was fascinating. If we're in the cognitive realm and then do fully commit to the mission, is that when our magic mental snakes appear? I keyed into the fact that we are in the cognitive realm, and it wasn't until he committed to the trip that the snake appeared.
Since you keyed into that, let me read you something else.
Okay.
I think I'm in the right place here. Yeah, this is where he's like kind of analyzing the snake as it's a distance away. It was long and narrow like a snake, but it seemed larger and longer than any snake he'd seen. Dimensions were difficult to judge, but he guessed its head was a good foot wide, maybe a body, maybe 5 feet long. One that was more plated than scaled. It swam with a sinuous motion, swimming in wide curves, its body lined with faint lights. Odd, he thought. That was how he'd always imagined shadows, the beasts that prowled the seas near the Pantheon Islands. He'd seen artist drawings of all his life depicting them as serpentine-like creatures, extensions of the Dakwara, the great god of snakes, who had infinite coils extending into every ocean. However, he'd now actually seen shadows, or deep walkers, as a scientist called them. He'd seen them up close, killed by modern weapons, their carcasses pulled up on the beach. They had legs, were more crustacean than serpentine. And then he starts to ramble on other stuff. But did you catch the emphasis there kind of in the middle?
Yes, that he's seeing exactly what he expects to see in the unseen. Interesting. Interesting. Yes. So maybe we will meet a snake as long as the planet or whatever it is, an endless snake, because that's what he's expecting. This fascinating. Interesting. Okay.
Maybe.
Okay.
Back to the navigation stuff real quick. If my back and forth straight lines method doesn't work, I thought of a better one. And this one plays off of the infinite horizon that we talked about last week with my little diagrams and math equations we pulled out. He does lose sight of the island, which doesn't bother me too much because, like we talked about before, there's probably particles in the air. It's probably it's not blocked by the horizon. It's just slightly a tiny bit foggy out there. There's particles in the air. He can't see it. But there's a very simple way for them to fix that. A lighthouse. All they have to do is build a lighthouse on that island and put the brightest light they possibly can on top of it. And because there is no horizon, you should be able to see that light from a very, very long way away. It would be like the stars that we see in our night sky. You walk out at night and you can see a star that is millions and millions and millions of miles away. Yes, I know stars are ridiculously bright and they're not going to be able to put that in a lighthouse, but they're still going to be able to light a big enough fire that you should be able to see for 100 miles, I think. Yeah. So I think a lighthouse would solve a lot of their problems.
The the Horizon line, going back to this cognitive realm thing, I think he loses sight of the island when his brain tells him he should lose sight of the island.
Yeah, that is interesting. I didn't think about that, actually.
I think his brain is creating a horizon line for him because he's such a skilled yeah. navigator. He knows the size of the planet that he's on in theory, and so his brain knows when he should lose sight of this island. So I actually think that's what's going on here, is that the cognitive realm is just responding to his brain of I've sailed for 6 hours or whatever. I shouldn't be able to see the island behind me. And oh, yep, it's not going to be there.
Which maybe jives with the kind of story we got before of, oh, we sent out crews, but they got lost because their radios didn't work. Well, what if they were kind of expecting that? They right. were thinking, oh, I'm in a crazy, weird place. Oh, no, we're going to get lost and the radios are going to stop working. Oh, look, the radios stop working.
Or he sails just out of view of the island and thinks to himself, yeah, there's no way I'm going to refine that island. Well, yeah, now you're correct because right. now the island's gone. Like,
right. So yeah, maybe my lighthouse idea would not work because of that.
Interesting. Cognitive realms, fun stuff, Brandon.
All right. One final thought for you guys. I realized on my reread here, as I was reading chapter 24, that Dusk's bird Sack, the raven, is really just the Cosmere R2-D2. And the reason I arrived at this is because Dusk is talking to Sack, and all Sack ever does is chirp back at him. But it's a very like sarcastic response. Dusk always feels like he's getting mocked by Sack, which is
Sock.
I feel like that is the role that is played in Star Wars by R2-D2. Characters make a comment to R2-D2. R2-D2 chirps back a bunch of sounds. No one knows what R2-D2 is saying, but I guarantee you every time R2-D2 opens his mouth, he's making fun of somebody. That is Sock here, I think, in the Cosmere.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. I think you're absolutely right.
So now we just need to get Cosmere R2-D2 onto Cosmere Millennium Falcon.
We got to find Cosmere C-3PO.
C-3PO, yeah.
Then we'll have it all.
Created by the Dark Lord.
Okay.
All right. Well, anything else, guys?
Nothing else from me. Maybe we need to add like a Jedi to our
yeah.
ship here as well.
Now I'm just trying to think who would be the Cosmere equivalent of C-3PO. Who did Taravangian make before becoming Retribution?
Aren't some of our Sions like overly literal?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good shout. That's all I got.
All right.
Likewise.
Well, I think
we'll turn the page and see a Starling flashback chapter.
Well,
pattern's obviously the
You're right. But
why did that take us so long? It's obviously pattern.
That's true.
I'm ashamed. We should have known that.
I'm sorry, everyone in the comments who was typing pattern. you can leave it, but I did get there eventually.
We would have gotten a flood of corrections there on that one. And you all would have been absolutely right, but Trevor, you saved us.
I saved it.
Total embarrassment. With that, let's wrap it up here for episode 281. Next week, for episode 282, we're going to be reading chapters 25 through 28 of Isles of the Ember Dark. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Trevor.
See ya.
No Starling flashback chapters.